Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, Fire Keepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Steve Vanderwall. Steve is the Deputy Chief of Rock Normal, Rochester's chapter for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, as well as the founder and CEO of TIBA. He is also a graduate of the Simon School of Business. Please join me in welcoming Steve Vanderwall.
Good morning, everyone. How are we doing this morning? So like she said, my name is Steve Vanderwall. I am the Deputy Chief of Rock Normal, and we are the Rochester chapter for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. We are the largest and oldest consumer advocacy organization in the world, spanning over 165 chapters nationwide. We were founded in 1970, so we're coming up on our 50th anniversary. And our chapter alone was founded just over a year ago, right in Rochester, and we have been behind much of the political reform that is happening at the state level. So I'm here today to talk about the positive sides of why we should legalize cannabis. And if you'll allow me to nerd out for a second, I'd like to start with a little bit of the science, which I think is something that we can all universally agree on. And in order for you to do that, I need us to take a trip back to about 7th and 8th grade health classes when we started talking about the human body systems. Things like the digestive system, the circulatory system, the reproductive system, the immune system. Everybody is familiar with these body systems. And what we need to do now is there needs to be an additional body system added to that list. And that body system is called the endocannabinoid system. And this endocannabinoid system is an incredibly complex biochemical signaling system that has receptors all over your brain and body. And these receptors interact with molecules called cannabinoids, okay? And the cannabinoids that we're most familiar with are THC, which is the psychoactive component in cannabis that gets you high, and CBD, which is the new buzzword miracle drug that has now emerged out of the hemp industry. And we're gonna get to those cannabinoids in a second. But first, is anybody aware that our bodies actually make our own endogenous cannabinoids that interact with the system? Most likely not. There's two of them, actually. The first one is called anandamide, okay, anandamide. And anandamide is the cannabinoid that's associated with the runner's high, okay? You know that feeling you get when you go for a long run and there's this euphoric feeling? I tend to feel a little more pain and disdain, but I have colleagues and coworkers and family that swear by this notion of a runner's high, this phenomenon of a runner's high. And contrary to popular belief, it's actually not the responsibility of endorphins, okay? It's actually the release of a cannabinoid called anandamide. The second cannabinoid in question that our bodies make internally is called 2-AG, okay? 2-AG. And what research is showing right now that the 2-AG is being shown in abundance in women's breast milk, okay? Something that we know has profound cognitive benefits for you or for infants that are breastfeeding. So now let's talk about the buzzwords, the cannabinoids that we all know and love, THC and CBD. So like I said before, there's this endocannabinoid system with receptors in your brain and body. And the first type of receptor that is in the system is called CB1, okay? CB1 is located in your brain, and CB2 is located in your peripheral nervous system, mainly in your immune system cells. So THC has a very unique relationship with CB1, okay? And there's this area behind your that sits right behind your forehead called the prefrontal cortex, which is a brain region that is responsible for cognitive function. Things like attention, memory, decision making, right? Things that all are coincidentally impaired when you smoke high THC cannabis. So it won't come as a surprise to you when I tell you that THC and CB1 has a direct lock and key binding affinity. They go together like PB&J. You smoke high THC cannabis, your CB1 receptors in your prefrontal cortex get flooded. Lo and behold, you have these cognitive impairments. It is not rocket science. It is a very simple biological mechanism. CBD, on the other hand, which has been surfaced as this miracle cure-all drug, right? actually doesn't have any binding affinity to CB1 really at all, not like THC, which is why it's physically impossible to get high off CBD. There's no interaction in your psychoactive receptors. Rather, it has a rather unique relationship with your CB2 receptors, which, if we remember, are in your immune system cells. And what CBD seems to do is act as a chemical messenger, essentially a delegation molecule that tells your immune system where in your body you need the most recovery and repair. Now remember, our immune system is our body's natural defense mechanism, our natural recovery system. And CBD seems to interact with these molecules in such a way to tell your body where in your body needs the most recovery, which is why people across the entire country are using this molecule for such an array of things. Not because it's an anxiety drug, not because it's a depression drug, a pain drug, a headache drug, a fibromyalgia drug. It's because it's an immune system enhancing drug, okay? So let's talk about what we know right now. We know that we have this robust endocannabinoid system. We know that that interacts with cannabinoids. We know that our body makes two cannabinoids, right? Anandamide and 2-AG. We know that about THC and CBD and their unique, very different and unique relationships with the endocannabinoid system. But what is the most profound and substantial thing that really fuels my obsession with this industry is that research have discovered over 100 other cannabinoids, all that interact with your body's endocannabinoid system in their own unique way, yielding biologically different results, i.e. THC and CBD. And you guessed it, each one of these cannabinoids can all be derived from cannabis. Now, to me, that seems like there's a rather unique symbiotic relationship between cannabis and human beings. And it's almost like we've been biologically designed to consume this plant. And I don't know about you, but I can't think of another resource or another plant or another anything that has this type of interaction with the human body that cannabis does. Now, for me, the science is what sells me, okay? I grew up studying cognitive science. I studied cognitive science as an undergrad, so I really have quite the taste for this. But there's a lot of other huge benefits from cannabis, and now we can start talking about the economic and agricultural benefits. So we are on the brink of an agricultural revolution. A crop like hemp is exponentially more valuable than a crop like corn. And we start to talk about economics, we can look to states like Colorado, who have seemed to be the poster child of a good cannabis economic industry. And let's keep in mind that Colorado is one-fifth the size of us in terms of population, right? And within last year of January 2018 and August of 2018, this small state generated $1 billion in revenue derived from cannabis, okay? We have the financial infrastructure, the agricultural infrastructure, the business infrastructure to do up to 10 times that, okay? Colorado's using a lot of this money to better their communities, like build schools and help integrate those who have been hurt most by the war on drugs back into society and give them equity and inclusivity in this industry. But before we can start talking about things like a farming revolution and the science and the money that's to be made, there's something that we have to address first and foremost, which is the platform that my organization runs on, and that is the topic of social justice. Because there are people, and a lot of people that don't look like me, who have been arrested, prosecuted, and thrown in jail, whose lives have been completely ripped apart, communities who have been completely ripped apart by this exact plant that we're sitting here talking about profiting off of in the very near future. Our biggest and first priority is to give these people justice. We're talking things like resentencing, resealing, expungement of records, right? Using this tax revenue into community reinvestment funds to help these folks who have been their lives have been destroyed by the war on drugs, integrate back into society and actually have a piece of this pie and build a program based on equity, inclusivity, and diversity. Now, for me, these arguments at this point seem like, duh, cannabis should be legal. I can't possibly think of any reason why. We're looking at an agricultural revolution. We're going to revolutionize the way that we heal ourselves, the way that we treat ourselves. Financially, we're looking at communities, small communities who are being economically revitalized from this plant alone. Okay, but there's still a few institutions, and mainly law enforcement, which you're going to hear from in a couple weeks, that are still riding this oppositional wave. And to be honest, I can't blame them, because if we think about it, these are the folks that have been institutionally ousted from participating in this industry. You can't work in law enforcement and consume cannabis. You can't work for the state or federal government and consume cannabis. And not only have you been ousted from participating, but you've been taught to criminalize this plant in your industry. Okay, so we can't blame the folks who aren't as educated on the subject matter as we are. But where I start to get frustrated is where we continue to have these conversations with law enforcement and those in opposition who are riding the same wave of arguments that we've continued to scientifically and statistically debunk over and over again. And one of the issues that you're probably going to hear on the 21st when the sheriff of Onondaga County comes in is the issue of impaired driving. Okay, and that's also a huge concern for us. The last thing we want is people to smoke cannabis, get in their car, and all of a sudden we have this big public health issue. But the problem is they want to treat it just like alcohol. And what we know about the biology of the way cannabis, specifically THC, interacts on the human brain is fundamentally different than the way alcohol acts on the human brain. Let us not forget that alcohol is toxic. It is a poison. Okay, people die on a daily basis from the overconsumption of alcohol. And just to let everybody know, we're still, in the history of cannabis dating back to 10,000 BC, we still have zero recorded deaths from the overconsumption of cannabis. Treating cannabis and alcohol, putting them in the same category, is like talking about alcohol and you know, drugs, crack, cocaine. We can't even put them in the same category. So for us, it's like, a lot of the data that they keep referencing goes back to studies from Colorado, and there's this one study in particular that they keep referencing saying, since legalization occurred in Colorado, there's been a 62% increase in traffic fatalities where THC was present in the bloodstream. Yes, that is true. But what they didn't tell you is that THC is a fat-soluble molecule that stays in your bloodstream for 4 to 6 weeks. So let me give you an example. 2 weeks ago, I decided to smoke a joint with a friend of mine. I stay clean for the next 2 weeks, and on the way here, I'm driving here, I'm turning on my radio, and I bend over to change the radio station, and while I'm doing that, I swerve over the middle yellow line because I'm not paying attention. Officer comes up behind me and pulls me over and says, son, it looks like you're impaired. Test does a blood test on me, I test positive for THC. Lo and behold, I find myself in a very similar situation as I would with a DWI. Now, whether you consume cannabis in your life or never in if you never have, I think we can all agree that there's not a two-week impairment window on this substance, right? We cannot treat cannabis like alcohol. Granted, there is not a best way. There is no objective measure right now, which is why we need to work with local law enforcement as the experts, and as them, the experts in law enforcement, to find something that does work, right? Because THC testing, it's out of the question. It's not, we cannot use it. But now there's a lot of developments in cognitive testing, where, you know, maybe before you, when you consume cannabis, there's an app on your phone where you take some sort of cognitive test, right? But what we don't know right now is there's not enough research. Another one of the arguments that they continue to ride is, what about the drug dogs, the canine units that we've paid a lot of tax money dollars for to train on detecting cannabis? What's going to happen to them? They're going to render them useless. Well, let's be clear. If that were to happen and there was no more need for these drug dogs, it's not like these drug dogs are going to be euthanized, right? Is there anybody in here that would have liked to retire early, right? That's what we're talking about. These canines, they're going to be able to retire early and actually have a life living as pets or used as other tools in this industry. It's not like they're just going to go away. It's a very weak argument. The next argument, which continues to make me laugh, and I have to continue to scratch my head when I hear not only police officials say that, but people higher up in government, is like, what about the gateway drug, right? Cannabis causes people to, it's a gateway into harder drugs and violence. That has been scientifically debunked on multiple different cases. And if we look back at the biology of cannabis, research is actually showing that the cannabinoids that I talked about in our science pitch a few minutes ago are actually mitigating the impulsivity of addiction at a biological level. people are using cannabis to take themselves off of harder drugs and alcohol and tobacco. The gateway drugs theory does not exist. It is an exit drug. And lastly, one of the big arguments that we hear is, well, what about the kids, right? And I'll be the first to admit, with a cognitive science background, I don't think children should be consuming THC before in their adolescence. It can't be healthy, right? But as I'm a responsible gun owner, and I have been for the last 15 years, and if I'm having a family function or a bunch of guests over, am I going to leave my loaded firearm sitting on the kitchen table for everybody to access? No, that's crazy, right? Why? There's a certain level of social responsibility and accountability that we're not factoring into any of these arguments. Anybody ever been on prescription pills before, okay? Are you going to leave your open bottle of pills around a whole bunch of kids at a birthday party or something? No. We have to discuss responsibility and social accountability, which brings me to education. Okay, this is clearly an issue and clearly a topic that needs a lot of education. Okay, and in 80 years of reefer madness, it makes it very difficult to educate those whose mindset has been focused in a completely different direction, and it's not their fault. You know, as an organization, we are not an adversarial organization. We are not a conflicting organization. We do not look to make enemies. We're stoner activists, okay? Peace. But at what point are we going to begin to scratch our heads? Because these arguments, we're continuing to have these arguments with our local PD sheriff, our district attorney, Sandra Dooley, our county executive, Cheryl Denolfo, all these people that are just holding on to the last piece of opposition, when in reality, there is no more argument. The benefits of legalizing this industry exponentially outweigh the negatives. So I want to close with something. Okay, we are truly in the middle of a life-changing, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The cannabis is the new frontier, okay? And most people have kind of molecularized this industry by the notion that THC gets you high, right? That's all that most people really can associate this industry. But let me tell you about what we are advocating for. It has nothing to do with getting high, okay? It's an awesome benefit, but it has nothing to do with what we're pushing for. Because whether we want to admit it or not, we've been finding and consuming cannabis for the last 80 years, and whether or not it's legalized tomorrow or in 50 years, the fact that all of our neighboring states and now countries are legalizing this, we're going to have more access to better products for cheaper. So as a consumer, doesn't really bother me. I'm still going to get product, and it's going to be easy. This is about everything else. I encourage people to continue this conversation, okay, because it matters. You know, for a long time, there's a lot of cannabis consumers and a lot of cannabis advocates out there who have been in the closet because it's been a scary thing to talk about, okay? But now that this reform is happening, people are coming out of the closet and having a lot of the tough conversations, which we're realizing aren't really that tough, okay? It's a matter of education. And our organization prides itself on education, okay? We were founded just over a year ago. There are three of us sitting on the board of directors. Everyone has full-time jobs. None of us get paid for this. And up until 30 days ago, we didn't even have a bank account. And with strategic partnerships and political moves and education at the forefront, we have been a driving force behind the change that's happening at a state level. And it's not because we're some miracle activists or we have, you know, silver spoons in our mouths or have access to all these people. It's because it's a matter of educating people and getting it in front of the right people. We are working with a small group of individuals in Syracuse who have expressed interest in setting up a normal chapter, because we have one in Buffalo, we have one in Rochester, we have downstate in New York City, that's Empire State Normal, but what we lack is right here in the eastern side of I-90. If there's anybody that is interested in getting involved or continuing this conversation, I encourage you to reach out and get a part of this movement, because this movement is going to revolutionize the way we heal and treat ourselves, the way we farm. It's going to revolutionize economics and small business, and it's going to help bring a voice back to the people who don't have one anymore, or who don't have one because of the mass incarceration and the criminalization that's had from this industry. So I want to thank you all for giving me a chance to speak on this. I love talking about cannabis. I think that it's something that once we start to see the full picture behind the notion of getting high, we can see the possibility. and all the possibilities that are going to come from this industry. So thank you very much for having me.
All right, well, thank you very much for a scientific approach to all of this. I'm obviously concerned about the financial impact, but I have a more basic question. The impairment issue. So THC does have an impairment effect. So how long does that impairment effect last? And, you know, what kind of, limits should we be setting on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of variables that go into quantifying impairment from cannabis, because unlike alcohol, where we have a really objective number, 0.08, that for cannabis, it matters on habituation. You know, how frequently are you using it? There was a study that came out a couple years ago that tested two sample groups. One was a group of habitual daily smokers, and one were weekend smokers, and they ran them through a series of driving tests. What the study showed was actually the habitual smokers showed no statistical significance, right? Essentially zero impairment, but the weekend smokers showed statistical impairment, some significance. There's definitely a correlation between how frequently you consume. So we have to talk about things like how frequently you consume, what type of products are you using, right? Are you using THC salves? Are you consuming, you know, smokable flower? Are you smoking wax? What's the percentage of THC? You know, body chemistry takes a huge, you know, there's a lot to take into it. So right now we know that there's not an objective measure, but we know the variables to put that we need to solve this problem. So now it's about putting those variables and really creating a problem-based solution.
I'm in favor of decriminalization, and I suspect that legalization is inevitable. But I have two concerns. One is your economic argument. I find that, frankly, somewhat annoying. That's the same argument that's been used for sports betting and so many other things. I think it's a way to get people on board because they want to look at the financial gain, and there are definite drawbacks to override the financial gain, in my opinion. The other thing, I was around, as I'm sure many of the people in this room were, when smoking became an issue. And because of a grassroots effort, people stopped smoking, reduced their smoking. We had symbols on packages to scare people away. I know there are different ways to ingest marijuana. I'm very concerned about ingesting it by inhaling it. I think that why are we going backwards in light of what we know about the problems with smoking?
Sure. So I'll answer your first question first about financials. I don't personally believe that the financial argument is the strongest. I think it's the most quantitative, the most quantifiable, right? It's numbers. The most important argument, no question, is social justice and providing restitution to the communities that have been hurt most by the war on drugs. But the problem is because this is a bipartisan issue, people that tend to lean more towards the right tend to have different priorities, things like agriculture, jobs, money. So at this point, we've created an array of arguments that fit everybody's profile, right? And it can't be denied. You know, we look at the economic impact is so profound. I mean, Colorado is using money to build schools. And coming from Rochester, where the Rochester City School District is in shambles, I bet you we could really benefit from some of that tax revenue. So I understand your distaste for the argument. It is a real argument, but it all depends on who we're speaking to. The second question in terms of inhaling, right? So that's the reason, so our medical program does exist. We do have a medical marijuana program that doesn't allow smokable flower because physicians can't ethically provide or offer something that we know that the inflammation from butane inhalation can be toxic, right? But that's what people want, right? So I think what we have to do is we have to offer them choices, right? Whether it's tinctures, whether it's lotions, whether it's vaporizers, but we have to give people autonomy because whether we offer it to them or not, they're going to do it anyway. So I think we have to just focus on creating other safe alternatives.
So let me just ask one quick follow-up with this.
Sure.
Medical marijuana, they are allowed to ingest through vaping.
Vaping,
how
yes.
Is that different? That's still dangerous.
So it's the difference in how the cannabis is actually heated. So butane, so just like if you think about a traditional piece of paraphernalia, you grind the weed up there and then you light it with butane, right? There's a butane toxicity that comes with smoking, right? So, and I don't know the exact temperature difference, but the vaporizer actually, I believe, vaporizes it at a lower temperature, so it's less toxic. I'll have to look at the metrics for that, but it is a bit different. But yeah, I mean, I would argue that inhaling marijuana is the least safe. But I think people are doing it anyway, and that's what the consumers want. So I can't possibly argue for being against inhaling marijuana when we are in the middle of an opiate epidemic. So while yes, there's probably some toxic effects that come with smoking weed, there's also people dying by the thousands, especially in our city, from prescription pills that have been commercialized on every drugstore wall and commercial we can possibly see. So if we're going to be true prohibitionists, we need to look at things like tobacco, things like alcohol, things like sugar-filled cereals that we're marketing to our kids. So if this is really an issue about public health, we have to address the full spectrum.
Thank you for a very well-prepared presentation this morning. I appreciate that. A couple of quick questions. If there are cannabinoids in breast milk, why do babies cry so much?
Now, that's an argument that I haven't heard. I appreciate that. Are you a new father?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay.
And I'm probably the reason babies cry so much.
Yeah.
As a follow-up, kind of to Carol's point, and I'm sure Chief Buckner may have made comment on this when he was here a few weeks ago about when the legalization ultimately comes down the pike, that he said, take a look at who's applying for the licenses and where those licenses and where those retail shops are eventually going to be opened, and look at the disparity of zip codes where those things happen. And I would encourage everybody here in the audience to reach out to their common counselors, their county legislators, and make sure that we've got the right protections to protect the most vulnerable neighborhoods and the most vulnerable communities in this city and in this region from impacts of stores like these. And I'm for it. And I've been to Colorado, and I've been to Portland, Oregon, and I've been to these shops, and they're wonderful, enticing places, and they sell these wonderful little gummy bears. And like you said, tinctures and flowers and edibles and all these great little things. And I learned the difference between 5 milligrams and 10 milligram dosages. And stay away from 10 milligrams, I would tell you that.
Hey, I saw something out of Portland, Oregon. They were selling 1,000 milligram THC brownies. That's like, I don't even know what would happen if, you know. So there's...
Wouldn't die.
You wouldn't die, but you would feel pretty bad, I think.
And I guess... that was my point. It really wasn't so much a question. It was just to your common counselors, to your legislators, please take a look between the disparities between where these licensees are going to be held and where they're going to open up their shops.
Yeah, so I have a couple comments on that. So one of the things we're advocating for in a piece of legislation called the MRTA, which was introduced by Senator Liz Krueger and co-sponsored by Crystal People Spokes. Crystal People Spokes, who's the majority leader of the House out of Buffalo. There is a prioritized licensing system. Right, so for people that have been incarcerated, people that whose lives have been ruined by this industry, women, minority-owned businesses, veterans, there's going to be a point system that allows these people to have first priority into getting these licenses, whether it's a cultivation license, manufacturing license, you know, retail license, whatever. So that's one of the first things that we're advocating for. And I think a lot of the problems that come with some of these shops in these areas is that cannabis is still federally illegal and still classified as a Schedule I drug. And until that changes, banking is going to become a huge issue. So one of the arguments that I didn't mention was, well, what about the pop-up in violence in places like Colorado? So we can attribute that to some of these head shops that just started right out of Breckenridge, Colorado. Right off their first week, they started doing over $50,000 a day in cash. Right? And when you don't have a bank, you're sitting there with hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in a small facility with virtually no security and insurance. You have a target on your back. So I don't care if you live in the worst part of the neighborhood or in Pittsford, New York, you have a target on your back. So we have to start thinking about what are we going to do to make these things safer? And that's going to be first addressing cash and being able to put the money in a safe place, providing insurance policies for these head shops, security, and all the things that you would provide to another business to keep them safe.
And I had a conversation with a client of mine in Rochester who's opening up 4 to 6 several CBD shops in and around Pittsford, Fairport, right around your area in Rochester. He can't find a bank who's willing to take his money because it's got CBD attached to it.
Canandaigua National Bank is now accepting. We can talk after.
Okay, I buy a lot of your argument, but it's still illegal in the United States federally. And I own a manufacturing firm, and I can tell when someone's drunk and comes to work and send him home. I can't tell when someone's got drugs in their system, and it's dangerous. Working on the machines, it's dangerous for the person who's next to you, because if something flies off, it hits them in the face. There's got to be some way to be able to test and notice this before they come to work.
Yeah, we need to be huge advocates of responsible use, you know, but what if you're prescribed something like an antidepressant or a pain drug and you take that before you come into work? You're impaired, you know? So it's like, for us, we first have to talk about why is cannabis at a Schedule 1? Because the two parameters for a Schedule 1 drug has a high potential for abuse and low medicinal value, right? Two things that have been scientifically debunked to the nth degree, but two things that also alcohol, high potential for abuse, low medicinal value, right? But it's one of the most commercialized industries. So while, yes, I do agree that we need to figure out a way to prevent people from using before, we have to talk responsible use, right? No matter what you do, whether it's substances, whether it's diet, nutrition, fitness, sleep, we have to have responsible use. So I think one of our biggest concerns and one of our biggest push points is finding a way to quantify impairment. And there's actually, I'll have to send you the study, there's this company out in the West Coast who's using this like cognitive testing machine. So when people come to work, it almost looks like an ATM and essentially runs you through an impairment test. I think so.
Employees for it, wow.
So it's like, if you pass this cognitive impairment test, right? Even if you are under the influence, are you still impaired? I don't know.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Hi.
Cannabis, you said, is not appropriate for young children, or could be harmful. What in our body changes from adolescence to adulthood that makes its consumption beneficial?
Yeah. The adolescent brain is very plastic and malleable, which means it's very susceptible to change in, you know, up until arguably 25 years old. So things like outside, you know, substances, obviously, coming from a broken home, a lot of situational and behavioral things, a lot of those things have a really strong impact on youth because their brains are so malleable and plastic. So we can see that the adolescent brain is much more susceptible to change than the adult brain. So my, you know, a little bit of scientific background would say you would want to keep any substances or any things that could potentially influence that brain in a negative way out of the hands of youth, which we don't believe that, you know, youth should be using THC, but now remember we have the other list of cannabinoids where people are using CBD. You know, the CBD revolution was really started by a young girl named Charlotte Feige out of Colorado, and she has a very severe form of epilepsy called Dravet syndrome. I think she was 8 or 9 years old at the time, and essentially she was living in a catatonic state with like 300 seizures a week, okay? Imagine seeing your kid seizing 300 times a week. Within one dose of CBD, she went from, in a regimen of CBD, she went from having 300 seizures a week to 2 a month with virtually no side effects, So while yes, I think we have to talk about cannabis in terms of cannabinoids, so yes, THC shouldn't be a part of a young child's brain, but then what about the other cannabinoids that are showing to be incredibly beneficial? So let's talk about CBD and the way that it interacts with your body's immune cells, right? We can argue that whether you're in utero or you are 95 years old, you have an immune system, right? We can argue that. And we could argue that people with stronger immune systems tend to be healthier and have the ability to fight off ailments properly, right? Is that a yes? So I would argue that if you add something like CBD into your immune system, whether you're in gestation or 1 year old or 95, and you have the ability to enhance your immune system, would you argue that that would be beneficial across all ages? Stronger immune systems equals stronger people.
New York State has about 700 or so police department sheriffs. I was wondering how they were able to pull that off to have every sheriff in New York State sign a petition against this particular program. And then secondly, will it have any effect?
The sheriffs really don't have much, the police don't really have much decision power when it comes to this industry. It's really going to come from the county executive level. So there's a piece of this, part of this legislation has written into it that counties have the opportunity to opt out of the industry, right? So everyone's automatically opt in, but we look at counties down in Long Island, like Nassau County, who have already said, we are out no matter what. So opting out of this industry prevents retail and sales and any businesses from happening in this county, but it doesn't prevent usage. So by opting out, people are just going to start flocking to the surrounding communities that have it to buy, to sell, whatever they want to do. And not only that, but the communities that opt out don't have the opportunity to take in the tax revenue, right? So you're really doing your community a huge disservice. In terms of how they got the entire, all of the sheriffs and police department to sign a petition, part of it is sticking to the blue line, you know, code blue. There's a certain type of loyalty that they have to amend to. But I can't imagine that all police are against it. I have police officer friends that consume that are like, yeah, we just kind of, you know, we have to follow what our command says. But a lot of it has to do with the lack of education. So us, we continue, as much as we keep beating a dead horse with these arguments, we have to keep pounding the counter arguments into their head, because it's only a matter of time before they flip. As you know, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any means, and I'll say this on behalf of Steve Vandewall, not on behalf of Rock Normal. My one argument, and something that makes me kind of, you know, ask a deeper question, is maybe there's something beyond these arguments that worries them. And historically, cannabis, specifically the odor of cannabis, has been used for a very powerful tool for search and seizure in terms of driving and getting weapons and guns and harder drugs off the street. And personally, I believe that there's a fear that that job is going to become a lot harder, okay? I want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt that it's a lack of education, but at what point are we going to start asking the hard questions? Because the arguments that they're riding on are flawed at this point.
City of Syracuse has $300 million of debt on its balance sheet. I would invite our political leaders to consider following the model in Norway of creating a sovereign wealth fund to accumulate revenue from the legalization process to build up a pool of assets for our city rather than a pool of debt.
Yeah.
Steve, thank you. Bill Waters from North Syracuse. Two questions. When you said you were stopped because you went over the yellow line, did they give you a breathalyzer test or another test? Yep. And number two, are there any court cases going on to fight the way that they evaluate somebody has cannabis in their system? As you say, it's very hard to determine. Are there any court cases going on to fight it?
The first was a hypothetical. That didn't actually happen to me, or I probably would have been late this morning. The second is, I'm not sure of local court cases, but I think out in Denver, or our sister chapter in Las Vegas is dealing with some similar, there's some court cases. We have a very knowledgeable attorney that sits as our legal advisor, and I'd be happy to put you in touch or even be able to dig up some of those resources for you, because I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Since I admire the energy and advocacy you bring to this, I believe if I heard correctly during the course of your comments, you said getting high is awesome. There's something about using language like that. If it's awesome at the level of legalized marijuana, if that were to come, and I know you had a very firm argument that this is not a gateway drug, but that kind of phraseology seems to me, well, if this is high and people have other options in this world that are not legal, it's an encouraging use of language. Well, that's what next step gets me higher. This is more a comment than it is a question, I suppose, but so long as I think you, somebody engaging this in an objective, science-based way that most of your comments were about, that kind of comment said, for some people, I still think this has a gateway quality. And I find that troublesome. I think that on the hemp side, what little I know about hemp, it seems peculiar that that's had this same limitation as some sort of Schedule I entanglement, yep, when it seems to have some really terrific industrial qualities to it. But for somebody my age and many in this room, when the extent you're exposed to marijuana when we were young and it was such an encumbered thing and it had all this social framework about it, the idea of getting high was really a way, setting aside some societal concerns, having a different sort of place in the socioeconomic system and view it yourself. It wasn't something to deal with health issues or psychological issues. It was more an entertainment quality. and something that, you know, I think fair to say, didn't make you a more contributing member of society. And for some of us who lived through that, it's hard to let that go. That, see, where is the upside of this, aside from what is you put forth as a strong proponent part of it, as it has certain medical qualities. And when your early comment about the human body somehow is designed to be symbiotically supported by cannabis really struck me as a bit over the top, but that's a side comment.
Okay. Well, let's talk about hemp and let's talk about hemp and marijuana for a second, because the hemp and CBD, or the THC and CBD industry, are now completely different industries, right? So marijuana, you know, first of all, cannabis sativa is the mother plant, right? That's the industry. But below that are daughter plants, essentially. And the first one historically is known as marijuana, which is high THC, low CBD cannabis. The devil's lettuce, that's marijuana. The industrial hemp industry was brought about by this loophole written into the legislation at the federal level, is that marijuana is only considered marijuana in a Schedule I drug if there is 0.3% THC or above in there, okay? I don't know who came up with that rule. I don't know where they got that number from. It is completely arbitrary. But the industrial hemp industry was built around that clause. So we have two different plants, which fundamentally the only difference is hemp has less than 0.3% THC and marijuana has high above that. So that's really kind of how the two industries were born. The argument about the endocannabinoid system, right? We talk about THC, we talk about CBD, anandamide, 2-AG, but there's these other secondary and tertiary components of this plant, such things like CBC and CBG and CBN, all the cannabinoids that no one's talking about that are real, coupled with things like flavonoids and terpenes, which are what give cannabis its experiential effects. So cannabis is not just a single molecule thing. It's a full spectrum thing where the sum of its parts are greater than the whole. And it's, you know, contrary to popular, you know, or contrary to Western medicine, it's like I go to the doctor for some back pain. Okay, here's a molecule. Here's a Vicodin. I come back a week later, doc, my back pain's going away, but now I'm having some constipation. Okay, here's a molecule. You know, come back a couple weeks later, I come back, doc, my pain's gone, my constipation's gone, but now I'm starting to have some anxiety and depression. Well, here's another molecule. And before you know it, you're playing this with this pharmaceutical seesaw, okay? Which is why people have an entire pill box worth of pills, because the second that you pull one of those pills out, you go into a physiological imbalance, and that's where ailments and problems start to arise. Cannabis contains that whole ecosystem of therapeutic properties in one plant. So by giving you just CBD or just THC, you're not doing yourself really any medical favor, right? It's the combination of all the cannabinoids and the ones that nobody's talking about or doing all the work. So endocannabinoid system science is very real. I would recommend looking into a doctor named Raphael Meshulam, who's from Israel, out of Hebrew University. Israel is really the pioneers of endocannabinoid health, and it is very real and it is very profound research. So I'd be happy to share. I have a whole portfolio of endocannabinoid research I could share with you.
Question about financing. So you said it was like one bank. How are people supposed to invest in the industry if it's huge?
You can't. A lot of people are investing in Canadian stocks because it's federally legal up there. Because most of the big banks are, cannabis could be legal in New York State, but the second that it crossed state lines, it becomes interstate commerce, and that's a federal thing. So you could be as legal as you want, but the second you step over the border into a legal state, it's a federal issue. And when that happens, it's a very risky thing, and most banks their finances are tied all across the country and all across the world. So until there's a federal deschedulization, we won't really be able to have banking. There are banks and smaller institutions that are now inching their way into the industry by starting with CBD. So there's, you know, in order to get a bank account for a CBD, you have to show a whole list of parameters for your product. Your hemp has to be grown in an institution that's in the industrial hemp pilot program protected under the 2018 Farm Bill. It has to have less than 0.3% THC. You have to show proven lab results with a certificate of analysis. You have to have all these parameters, and if you miss one of them, you don't get any banking. So it's very strict, but there are banks making very strategic moves by using CBD as a Trojan horse into the industry.
Back a little bit to the economics of this, regarding the state and its what seems to be inevitable legalization of marijuana, how they're going to tax it. To the comment regarding the Norwegian plan. I don't know exactly how that works, but I'm interested to find out how much control locally we'll have over what we connect or what we collect. Will there be state, local, and county taxes like there are with other things? Will there just be state taxes, and how do those get distributed back to the communities in which they're sold?
Right now, we're looking and we're advocating. I mean, we're not advocating for taxes by any means, but we're advocating for a state tax with a municipality tax. So it encourages municipalities to get involved, because then they're going to start seeing their tax revenue. Part of the MRTA, which is the bill that we want, the current bill that the governor released is the CRTA, right? Very different bills. The MRTA has a tax allocation program that devotes about 50% of the tax revenue into community reinvestment funds. So those communities that were hurt directly by the war on drugs, they're going to see that for job integration programs, education. We're looking to build incubator programs to help people who have been incarcerated for participating in this business integrate back into the community, back into the business, and then use incubators. Like we know incubators are already very successful, to be able to find, okay, you're a grower, you're an extractor, you want to own a store. How can we, you know, foster all these community resources and create one thriving local industry? So we hope to see a lot of the tax revenue go back to the cities, and then tax revenue for that go back to the communities hurt most.
Sorry, you just talked about the social justice implications of this, but can you be a little bit more specific about some of the ways that would actually work? I mean, I think we all agree the African American community has been devastated by this war on drugs. Can you talk? Are there more specific things that you would want to mention in terms of the way this would benefit or repair some of the social justice damage that's been done?
I don't even necessarily we can begin to talk about repairing, because this has been going on for centuries. Okay, this is not just cannabis. This is going to be a low and slow process, but their restitutions have to be on the forefront. We have to help these communities with infrastructure, help them with education, help with integrating into the business side of things, helping with agriculture, whatever side of the industry you want to get in, whether you want to get in or not, but using this tax revenue to start building up these communities from the inside out. You know, putting money into schools. That's what Colorado's doing. They literally just built a school from tax revenue from cannabis, okay? We have the potential to do 10 times that. Okay. And with the Rochester City School District in shambles that it is, my first thought is, why aren't we throwing money into the school district, right? Better education builds better communities, less violence, more prosperity. It just makes so much sense to me. But we're such a Band-Aid society that we tend to just put Band-Aids on things rather than looking at things from the roots. And that a lot of that comes from education and helping those communities that were hurt most. So I really hope that we can see much of the tax revenue go back into these.
Staying with social justice, so when New York State decided to approve having a lottery, at that time the pitch was that the money was going to go to education. Well, the money doesn't go to education, it goes into the general fund. In line with that, studies that have been done show that the people who have on the lowest end of the income spectrum are the ones who spend the most on lottery tickets. Why won't that be the same in this situation? And again, going back to the economic benefit, I mean, you hear all kinds of promises, but after it's done, there's no way you can make them live up to those promises.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's fair to compare gambling to medicine. I don't think that they can even be put in the same category. I know there's a lot of money that's going to be made, but it's apples and oranges.
People aren't consuming marijuana for medical reasons. I mean, some people are, but for recreational use, it's not for medical purposes.
How come? Because it wasn't prescribed by a doctor?
Because do you really believe that?
I truly believe that. That's why I'm up here.
Okay.
I would argue that, and here's the thing, we can, you know, our governor has a lot to do with this. So he is somebody that says one thing and does completely the other. For example, he had said in one of his inauguration speech or his 100-day speech, no longer will we accept campaign contributions for corporations. Awesome. Lo and behold, the biggest campaign contributor to Cuomo's last election was a company called MedMen, a billion-dollar cannabis company who gave him over $100,000, right? So his credibility he doesn't have any, right? So he pushes this agenda, social justice and no vertical integration in communities, but what he says is very different than what he does. So I think it's all going to be a product of, like, we had to literally, because on the outside of the legislation, it looks great, community reinvestment, small business oriented. But when you dig deep into this 400-page bill, you start to see little clauses that are completely against what he's promising. So I think that we have to be very critical in how we look at the legislation, and we have to take everything that, especially our governor, says with a grain of salt.
One comment to that. I agree. I think we get these sort of front-end sales pitches to do these things, which many of us feel, or some people feel, isn't really any good outcome. One difference in this, I think, is there is a marijuana industry. It's mostly illegal. It's untaxed. It's unregulated. I think there will be a positive bump if it became a legalized industry. I do think the idea you'll get a big kick out of it will only exist until all states are at the same level, and then it'll be a homogenized, there won't be any location advantage one state over another. The bump that Colorado gets will go away because customers won't be pulled to that market where they can't get anywhere else. So I do think, I'm fundamentally, I struggle with this, but the idea we have an embedded illegal industry with a whole untaxed marketplace at work and all the violence and issues that come with that. Clearly there's a market for it, there's a desire for it in our society, which I think is misplaced, but I can't be the judge of that. So I do think there would be a benefit, but I don't think it'll be anything like sort of the front-end sales quality that comes to it at this stage.
I mean, I think that we have to think about how we get cannabis now and how we'll get it in a regulated market, because notorious, you know, I grew up driving around different places in the city, getting in cars with people that I wasn't familiar with, getting products that I didn't have any idea what was in there, right? And that's pretty standard, right, for an illegal industry. But now we have an industry, when you walk into a store and you get a package that says it has 10 milligrams of THC in it, you're going to get 10 milligrams of THC because there's testing. We have to focus on quantitative, third-party, analytical testing, proper packaging, just like we do with food, just like we do with pharmaceutical drugs. We have to treat it like an industry. I'm not saying that this should be a free-for-all, no rules, everything goes. There have to be regulations, but there have to be smart regulations, because the industry's here. It's not coming, it's here. So we have to embrace it, and we have to utilize all the solutions that we have to a lot of the problems that, you know, we're talking about, because most of them already exist, right? We just have to take these solutions and put them into the cannabis industry, because none of these solutions are really that novel. It's a new industry. We're trying to treat it like things like alcohol. We're trying to regulate the hell out of it so we can extract all the tax revenue. But we look at a city or a state like California, who did exactly what New York wants to do and threw a 30% or 40% excise tax on it. So what's going to happen? There's going to be a huge influx to the illicit market, right? You look at Oregon, right? Oregon gave away unlimited amount of licenses, right? It was a free-for-all. So before you know it, the supply is vastly more than demand, and it's forcing these growers and these cultivators to go to the illicit market. They're selling pounds of cannabis for $400 or $500 when the street value and the market value is $3,000. So we have to find the happy medium between putting the appropriate amount of regulations on it so people don't influx or go to the illicit market. We have to do it from like a distributor and a business side where we don't give away too many licenses, so then we have either too much or too little. So it, you know, ironically, just like, you know, CBD keeps us in balance, this is a balance issue. So we have to make sure that we bring all the members of our community, whether it's public policymakers, public health commissioners, sheriffs, everyone that has their expertise, and come together and really start creating what no one's done. No one has done this perfectly. People have done this really well, but no one has done it perfectly, and because no one has thought, let's bring all the players to the game. Because it's always the activists against the big business, activists against law enforcement, right? But how about we address the fact that we're going to disagree on a lot of these issues, but rather than just running from it and continue to have these media battles and playing these fact wars and you said this and I said this, why don't we sit at the damn table and have a conversation and do this the right way? Because we have the chance to do it the right way and set the standard for every other state to follow. And now that we always are talking about Colorado and what they did, how about we start, hey, look what Rochester did, look what Western New York did. We have the potential to do that. We have the opportunity to do that. So it's really about bringing all the big players together, putting our differences aside, and doing this intelligently.
All right, please join me in thanking Steve VanderWaal.
Thank you.